This is audio file, made to MP3, of article. The Rise and Fall of Atlantis. This historic info from the far past is taken down car. 100 years ago, via Transmedi, Edgar Cayce, 1877-1945. This below is edited by Lytle Robinson. Ever since Plato wrote his startling account of a sunken continent, men have debated the reality of its existence. Indeed, no historical subject has produced more controversy and been of such persistent duration. Long since lost in antiquity, here is land and a people about which history officially knows nothing. In spite of Plato, a TMS story and some 25,000 volumes subsequently written on the subject, only the bravest of modern scholars give any credence to the Atlantean theory. The first recorded mention of such a land is in Plato's TMS Timaeus, written in the 5th century before Christ. Here the great philosopher describes a conversation between certain Egyptian priests and Solon, an Athenian statesman of the 7th century BC. The priests represented Atlantis as a great island larger than Asia Minor and Libya combined, lying just beyond the Straits of Gibraltar. It had been a powerful kingdom 9,000 years before the birth of Solon, in 638 BC, and its invading hordes had overrun the lands which bordered the Mediterranean. Only Athens itself had successfully withstood the Atlantean invasions. Finally, because of the wickedness of its inhabitants, earthquakes and the sea overwhelmed Atlantis and it disappeared into the ocean. In the unfinished Critias, Plato adds a history of the ideal commonwealth of Atlantis or the political utopia of another age. Pliny, the Roman naturalist, also discusses it in his Natural History, a sort of encyclopedia written in the 1st century AD. Early Arabian geographers place Atlantis on their maps. Medieval writers accepted it as true history, and their beliefs were substantiated by numerous traditions of ancient islands in the eastern seas which offered various points of resemblance to Atlantis. Some of these sunken islands were marked on maps as late as the 16th century AD. There are traditions of a great flood among almost all races of ancient peoples, indicating a common origin and a widespread acceptance of the legend. In the 17th and 18th centuries, the subject of Atlantis was still seriously debated, and its credibility admitted by such men as Voltaire, Montaigne, and Buffon. Francis Bacon, in his allegory, The New Atlantis, published in 1627, presents it as a symbolic utopia established on scientific principles, a high cultivation of natural science and the arts. Many attempts have since been made to rationalize the story of Atlantis, the best perhaps being Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, by Ignatius Donnelly. The land has variously been identified with America, the Scandinavian countries, the Canary Islands, and Palestinia, but usually with the main body of it lying in the North Atlantic. Perhaps its most prominent defender of modern times was Edward H. Thompson, archaeologist and American consul for 24 years to Yucatan, Mexico. He died in 1935, still convinced that the mysterious tribe of Mayan Indians of Central America was originally from Atlantis. A few others have held to this view despite the ridicule of the conservative element of science. Scholars have long tended to regard the whole story as invention, since no contemporary written records have been found. Little credence is given to the early accounts, the legends or the theory, although the latter does answer many otherwise unanswered questions. Plato, Pliny and Bacon are not known as writers of pointless fiction, and the story as a myth would appear to be grossly out of place in serious philosophic and historic works. Why they should now be accused of fabricating their accounts, except partially in the case of Bacon, is as regrettable as it is unrealistic and unlikely. Geologists have discovered that the coastline of Western Europe at one time extended farther in the direction of America than it does now, and that its submergence must have taken place long before history was recorded. There are known mountain ranges, ravines and ridges in the bottom of the Atlantic. Because of a broken cable running between Brest, France and Cape Cod, geologists found lava which proved to have hardened under atmospheric conditions and therefore above water less than 15,000 years ago. In Colorado, an ancient dog TMS skull of European origin was identified as that of a species 12 to 15 million years old, suggesting a land bridge to that continent. Archaeological findings reveal striking similarities between ancient Egyptian and Central American architecture, art and inscriptions, although the two lands are separated by thousands of miles of ocean. Atlantean migration to both areas is a plausible answer, especially since no other satisfactory solution to the problem has been put forth. Atlantis is first mentioned in the case records in a reading given in 1923. After that, many facets of its history appear hundreds of times in readings for different persons over a period of 23 years. The readings not only corroborate its existence and the best that has been written on the subject, but they supply much that is new and give a detailed and comprehensive picture of the land and its peoples. More than that, and perhaps most important of all, they relate its amazing civilization to our present age in a way that is stirring, convincing, and alarming. Interwoven in the last era of the Atlantean culture are factors that have direct and significant influences on the problems of current events at home and abroad. These are not by accident, and the numerous parallels between the two civilizations drive home the crucial importance of the decisions America now faces. From the case records, Edgar Case 2 post: when man entered the earth as a physical being, the land areas of the world were very different from what they are today. After the shift of the poles and the breaking up of the continents many thousands of years later, vast changes were to take place. The polar regions were then tropical and semi-tropical. Most of the North American continent was covered with water except for the states of Utah, Nevada, Arizona and New Mexico. These were fertile plains, as was the Gobi Desert of East Asia. The Andean coastal area of South America was underwater, as was most of that continent except the region of the southern Cordilleras and Peru. The upper part of West Africa, Egypt and the Sudan was above water, and the Nile emptied into the Atlantic Ocean. In Europe and Asia, the regions of the Carpathian and Caucasian Mountains, Norway, Mongolia and Tibet were above sea level. Iran and the Caucasus were rich lands of the Garden of Eden. The continents of Lemuria and Atlantis were the world TMS largest land areas. Lemuria, lying roughly in what was later to become the Pacific Ocean, extended from the western part of the United States to South America. The Andean coast was its tideland area, as were portions of Central America. Atlantis, occupying largely what was later to be the North Atlantic Ocean, was the most important land area. It compared in size to Europe and Russia combined. The eastern seaboard of the United States, then mostly underwater, comprised the coastal lowlands of Atlantis, which extended to the Gulf of Mexico and as far as to the Mediterranean Sea. The island of Bimini off the coast of Florida was a part of the continent, as were the Bahamas in the British West Indies and Yucatan in southern Mexico. When the perfect race appeared in Atlantis in what was known as the Red Race, the land was already inhabited by the monstrosities. These were the sole entities who had taken on all sorts of strange and grotesque bodies in order to experience material existence on the earth. They had existed for hundreds of thousands of years and, as in the rest of the world, had become all shapes and sizes, from pygmies to giants 12 feet tall, with many freakish abnormalities resulting from their mixing with the animals. At first they lived peacefully together, for the struggle of the sons of God to be fruitful, multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it did not at once meet active, organized resistance. Souls born with perfect bodies continued to enter the earth in large numbers to help keep the balance and prepare for the dissensions that later were to come with the sons of Belial, those of both races who turned away more and more from the divine will. But with this second influx of souls, some 10.5 million years ago, even in that day did they call upon the name of the Lord. Swiftly they banded together in a family and clan life. They ate the herbs and fruits of the now flowering earth, and for clothing wore the skins of animals to cover that portion of the body which had already brought such destructive influences in their sex relations with the monstrosities. They lived in rocks, in caves, and in trees. motivated by the desire to excel, to control, to dominate. Households, clans and then tribes came into existence, accelerated by the search for companionship, protection and trade. Quickly they learned that their well-being was dependent upon each other. The people of Atlantis were to pass through the same stages of development as the other four races in the various lands, although their progress was to be more rapid. Unlike the rest of the world, the Atlanteans as a nation were a peaceful people at this time and more readily made use of the laws of nature. Stone was first utilized in implements to secure food and protect themselves from the animals. At an early period, houses of wood, then of stone, circular in shape, were built. First the Atlanteans were hunters, then herders and farmers, using tools of stone and wood. Fire and natural gas were among the first discoveries, iron and copper quickly followed. Soon they were fabricating balloons from the hides of elephants and other large animals and using them for the moving of building materials. Communities and communication slowly came into existence. The monstrosities and the mixtures, hampered by cumbersome bodies and dull minds, made almost no material progress at all, except for that passed on to them by their masters. Physically, over the centuries, they gradually began to lose some of their animal appearance and instinct, through intermarriage and repeated reincarnation in the earth. But the real problem was with the animal kingdom. Enormous, carnivorous beasts roamed the forests of the mountains and the jungles of the valleys. Giant fowls hovered above the earth, feeding upon and devouring whatever was at hand. Physically inept in comparison, man had but one superior weapon of defense, the soul force, or mind. By exercising the power of will and reason, he was able to devise, to improvise, to outwit. By this means alone was he able to survive the brute strength of the animals, whose rule was the survival of the fittest. Still relatively close to God, although he had fallen into matter, man during his first 1,000 years on earth was possessed of a body through which the soul expressed itself much more easily than later was to be the case. Occult powers were commonplace. The third eye, or pituitary gland, located near the center of the forehead, was highly developed. Through this gland functioned the creative psychic abilities of the soul. Those of the perfect race thereby had knowledge of happenings in distant places and foreknowledge of events to come. They also had the power to control the monstrosities and subject them to their will. Yet man was continually drifting away from his source and submerging more and more into the material world with all its temporal interests. Thus he was eventually to lose for all practical purposes to this God-given power. These gifts of the spirit would remain submerged until men had again spiritualized themselves in thought and deed. Few were able to do so. The animal kingdom became an increasing problem, and the constant threat of death made life miserable. A council of the wise men of 5 nations of the world, representing the 5 races, was called around 52,000 BC. Representatives came from the white race in the Caucasus, the Carpathian Mountains of Central Europe, and Persia, from the Yellow Race in what later became the Gobi Desert, the Black Race in the Sudan and Upper West Africa, and the Brown Race in Lemuria. In the first meeting for united action, ways and means were planned for combating the creatures overrunning the earth in so many places. Discussions for defense centered around the use of the potent chemical forces in the elements of the earth and air. The decisions made proved to be effective, but they had unexpected and far-reaching consequences during the years ahead. The mixtures and monstrosities were the outcasts of society. Frequently of low principle and little self-will or control, they were used for the most menial tasks. Their status in the social scale was little higher than that of domesticated animals and beasts of burden. Because of them, men of the perfect race fell into 2 camps. Bitterly opposed to each other in ideology. It was the mixing of those of pure lineage with those who had not completely overcome the animal influences that brought dissensions and the rise of strife and turmoil. These outcasts, enslaved by those of Belial, the followers of Baal or Beelzebub, the forces of evil, were treated very harshly. Through the use of occult powers, hypnosis and mental telepathy, They were under complete domination of their masters. They were bred like cattle for particular types of work and enjoyed none of the fruits of their labor and very little home life. Commonly known as things are the untouchables, the automations, as they did all the work in the fields, the households, and some of the trades. Castes and classes came into being, fostered by the sons of Belial through greed, contempt and hatred. Bloodshed resulted from this disregard of and disrespect for the rights and freedom of others. The many were subjected to the whims of the few for their own self-aggrandizement. The laws of heredity and environment gradually became more of an influence. Appearances changed according to the purity of the strain and individual purposes, ideals and motives of activity. There were some who were almost perfect in figure and feature, and others who had monstrous combinations of human physiques and animal appendages, such as hooves, claws, feathers, wings and tails. It was these strange creatures who later were to be so mysteriously depicted in Egyptian and Assyrian inscriptions at an early period in Egypt. They were finally to disappear from the human race. These daughters of men and giants in the earth of the Old Testament were the reason for the admonishment, "Keep the race pure." Yet the mixtures sometimes produced divine bodies with twisted, warped souls, or repulsive bodies with souls seeking the light. It was not the body that mattered so much, but the purity of purpose, of ideals. Through the injunction, "If you will be my people, I will be your God," an effort was made by the more spiritual-minded to draw people to the worship of the one God. Known as the children of the law of one, they sought to purify the race in purpose as well as in body. The tenets of those of the law of a near one religion, one state, one wife, one home, one goda had little appeal to the sons of Belial. The first altars were established for the sacrifice of the fruits of Manitiam's labors, the harvest of the fields and the flocks of the pastures. Religion came into being, motivated by what man felt but no longer knew to be true, although the law of one has always been the same: "Eo love ye in your daily experience." Apply in your daily activities the love that ye would have the Father show ye. In your relationships to your fellow man, do ye know the law of one. A that was the first creed, established upon the first law of God to his children: "Hear, O Israel, seekers. The Lord thy God is one. Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Temples were established, and soon the symbols of religion, ceremonies, rituals, prayers and chants were instituted. The sacred fires were started as the shrine of the pure and the means of cleansing and spiritualizing the mixtures who came seeking enlightenment and a more divine purpose in their lives. Religion was slowly developing as a system, a method of reminding man of his divinity. The continuity of life, or reincarnation, was recognized as an essential part of the plan of evolution for the soul. Karma, the law of cause and effect in action, or "as ye sow, so shall ye reap," was fundamental. Thus the breach between those of the law of one and those of Belial slowly took form, a breach that later was to widen into a gulf. The carnal, materialistic way of life of the followers of Belial was attractive even to many of the children of the law of one, and numbers of them succumbed to the temptations. With the emphasis on the value of temporal things and the de-emphasis on the spiritual, idol worship crept into the religious scene. The first of the series of three continental catastrophes occurred many thousands of years before the final drowning. It came as a material result of the use of chemicals and high explosives in the plan to annihilate the wild beasts. The real reason was the low state into which man had fallen. Huge and numerous gas pockets were blown open in the lairs of the animals, precipitating volcanic eruptions and earthquakes in the still slowly cooling earth. The magnitude of the disturbances caused the axis of the world to shift, bringing the poles to their present position and producing the last of the great ice ages. Lemuria was the first to be affected, losing much of its territory as it began to sink into the Pacific. In Atlantis, the area of the Sargasso Sea, off the west coast of Cuba, was the first to go underwater. The rest of the continent was broken up into several large islands with many canals, ravines, gulfs, bays and streams. the temperate climate rapidly changed to a more torrid one. With the upheavals, the initial migrations from Atlantis took place in small numbers to the east and west. The earliest settlements were in the region of the Pyrenees Mountains in France and Spain, then later in Central and South America. The movement of the Lemurians was primarily to South America. The land of Og, along the Pacific coastal area of what was later to be southern Peru, was occupied. This was the beginning of that mysterious tribe of Indians known as the Incas. The Rise and Fall of Atlantis, Part 2. From this time on, although material civilization rose to great heights, there was growing unrest among the Atlantean people. In a land of plenty, strife rather than peace became the rule. The altars came to be used for human sacrifice by those turning away from the original concept of the one God. Sun worship became prevalent. Only the dedicated, inner core of the children of the Law of One remained firm. Low standards of morality, sex indulgence and perversion became rampant. Poverty and hunger were widespread among the peasantry and working classes. There was a deteriorating of the physical and spiritual bodies, just as there was a wasting away of the mountains and valleys into the seas. In spite of material advancements and many scientific achievements, inner decay was to bring dispersion and finally annihilation to a proud, wicked, adulterous people. The second important land change came long after the first, around 29,000 BC, and resulted in the submergence of many large islands. The Bible gives an account of it in the story of Noah and the flood. After the deluge, which was preceded by volcanic eruptions and electrical storms, the principal land areas left in this part of the world were the islands of Posidia in the Northwest Indies area, areas in the Central Atlantic and Og, Peru, in the west. There were large movements of the people to these lands as well as to other parts of the earth. Lemuria vanished into the Pacific Ocean. Some of its inhabitants fled to the safe lands of Lower California, Arizona and New Mexico, where they established the Brotherhood of Mu in the land of Aomera. For the Atlanteans it was the end of an era, and the beginning of a new one unsurpassed in many ways. After the days of the flood, a period of rebuilding began in Atlantis. The Atlantean scientific turn of mind combined with their energy and aggressiveness made possible great strides forward in mechanics, chemistry, physics and psychology, for in many ways the Atlanteans were a superior people. In certain fields they were more learned than any civilization since. When electricity was discovered after the first upheaval, it paved the way for remarkable developments in the field of electronics and electrical devices. Atomic power, from uranium, came to be understood and used in transportation and the movement of heavy objects. It was also abused, for selfish purposes. The Atlanteans had more efficient systems of heating and lighting, and communications with other lands were well established. Light rays of many kinds, such as laser beams, were discovered and controlled, including the death ray. Liquid air was manufactured, also compressed air and rubber. Metal alloys of brass, aluminium and uranium, unknown to us, were used in the construction of air and water craft, including the submarine. The telephone and the elevator were in common use, radio and television were highly developed, as was the amplification of light rays in telescopic observation and photographing at long distances. Many types of bodily adornment came to be fabricated. Soldiering and law enforcement became a part of the political scene. But the most notable scientific accomplishment of the Atlanteans was the harnessing of the Sun TMS energy. Developed originally as a means of spiritual communication between the finite and the infinite, the huge reflective crystals were first known as the Tuoi stone. Later, as its use was improved upon over the centuries, it expanded to become a generator of power or energy, radiating across the land without wires. Then it became known as the Firestone, or the Great Crystals. Set in the Temple of the Sun in Posidia, the Firestone was the central power station of the country. Basically, it was a large cylindrical glass or stone of many facets, capped with a mechanism at one end. It was suspended in the center of the building and insulated with a non-conductive material akin to asbestos but resembling bakelite. Above the stone was a dome which could be rolled back for exposure to the sun. The concentration and magnification of the SNITMS rays through the many prisms was of tremendous intensity. So powerful was it that it could be regenerated and transmitted throughout the land in invisible beams similar to radio waves. Its energy was used to power ships at sea, aircraft and even pleasure vehicles. This was done by remote control through induction methods to the apparatus in the craft. Cities and towns received their power from the same source. The human body could even be rejuvenated through the moderate application of the rays from the crystals, and man often rejuvenated himself. Yet by misapplication, the firestone could be and was turned to destructive uses as well as the means for torture and punishment. Tuned too high and not intentionally, it contributed to the cause of the second catastrophe. The rays combined with other electrical forces to start many fires deep within the earth, and volcanic eruptions were precipitated from Naturatium's powerful storehouse of energy. Beautiful stone cities that glistened in the sunlight were scattered across the land. Among them were Amaki, Achai, and Posidia, the latter being the most important city of the day. It was located on the last of the great islands designated by the same name. Here on the Bay of Paphos was one of the best and busiest seaports of the world. Water was supplied to the buildings of the city and the many pools and lagoons by viaducts built to nearby mountain streams. So huge and numerous were these conduits that they gave the appearance of a walled city. Water sports were highly popular. The buildings were constructed in tiers with gleaming, polished stones and intricate mosaics of superior craftsmanship. In the center of the city was the temple, around which much of the life of the children of the Law of One revolved. Supported by huge, semicircular columns of onyx, topaz and beryl inlaid with amethyst and other colorful stones, the elaborate temple reflected the rays of the sun from a variety of beautiful angles. Inside, the sacred fires of the altars burned constantly in the inner chamber. These mysterious flames produced rays of the knowledge of which was so soon to be lost to that were used in the treatments given the mixtures, animal-man creatures, for the removal of unwanted appendages. There was a large outer court which served as an assembly hall, and inner rooms for the prophets and the many priests, priestesses and attendants of the temple. The large priesthood was made up of the most learned men and women of the day, and some of them acted in the capacity of judges as well as spiritual and vocational instructors. The Atlanteans, and especially the Posidians, studied the creative energies of the universe and penetrated the essence of Naturatium's storehouse, the vibrations of plants, jewels and metals of the latter including their vibratory effect on the psychic and intuitive nature of man. Agriculture was highly advanced, as were astronomy and astrology. The Atlanteans calculated the meaning of numbers, the stars and the elements, and even knew the activity and effect of the morning dew. They learned how to neutralize the pull of gravity. They were aware of the mysteries of the origin of man and the five races, and they had a full understanding of the laws of metaphysics, of spiritual and scientific truths which are essentially the same. It was this wealth of knowledge possessed by those of the Law of One that was sought and misapplied by those of Belial, the materialists who rejected not only the ideas of the worshippers of the one God but also their precautions and warnings. There were some of the Law of One who listened to the arguments and the temptations offered by those of Belial and yielded, becoming collaborators with them in the desire to use for pleasure and destructive purposes the creative energies and laws of the universe. This misapplication was known as the Aeonites' ideal of the law, or of life. Many religious temples were degraded temples of sin as spiritual laws were applied to the satisfaction of the physical appetites. The misuse of psychic powers brought strife in many quarters. There was contention over the use of explosives, gases and liquid air for selfish purposes. Conflicts arose over special privileges and who were to be the leaders as well as which was to be the ruling party of the land. The slave, peasantry and working class were not only selfishly oppressed and abused, but heavily taxed as well. Party lines were thus sharply drawn between the two groups. Although those of the one god were ostensibly in power, large inroads in their authority and control were made by the opposition, the self-seeking groups. Civil war erupted. The form of government was a monarchy in a semi-socialist state. The king was aided in his rule by an inner council. In this there were evil elements, and deceit, intrigue and conspiracy were within the King Otiam's own household. Society was divided generally into three classes. The ruling class are those of both groups in positions of power and authority, including the high priesthood, the middle or teaching class or instructors and overseers, and the peasantry or laboring class, including the mixtures. There was also a line of royalty, and princes and princesses who loved the pomp and splendor about the King Otiam's court. The children of the law of one lived communally. The growth of disturbing factors within, the magnification of personal desires and embitterments, made the final destruction of Atlantis all the more certain. Advanced understanding of spiritual and natural laws and their misapplication made that destruction all the more terrible. Those of the one god realized, through the clairvoyant powers of the fast declining pituitary gland, that the impending final breakup of the Poseidon Atlantean lands was now at hand. They sought ways of warning and uniting the people in order to prevent it, if possible, so that they might still carry out the injunction, subdue the earth, rather than as those of Belial would have at our subdue one another. They endeavored to gather all the knowledge of the various nations of the world concerning the approaching disaster, and a meeting was called with this in view. Envoys from many lands came to Atlantis to pool their wisdom in a last attempt to avert the calamity, but the meeting and evangelistic campaign resulting from it were to no avail. Reconciled to the inevitable national cataclysm, the children of the Law of One made other plans, the search for suitable lands to colonize. Many expeditions went out for this purpose. The children of the Law of One also supplied leadership in the actual movements via land, air and water to the safer lands of Egypt, Honduras, Yucatan and other areas. Of special interest to them was the preservation of their religious tenets and records, and these were taken with them. By 10,700 BC, the country had reached the depths of moral and spiritual life here not in knowledge but in practice. Human sacrifice and sun worshipping were prevalent, as were adultery and corruption. The mixtures were used and abused. The forces of nature were misused. The sun crystals were cruelly adapted as a means of coercion, torture and punishment, and they became known among the common people as the Ao Terrible Crystalsa. A new low in morality and human dignity had been reached. Violence and rebellion spread across the land. Destruction of Atlantis II post then came the final catastrophe. Gigantic land upheavals shook the foundations of the earth. Great islands crumbled into the sea and were inundated. Only scattered mountain peaks remained to mark the sunken graves. Some people escaped, a few stayed behind heroically to aid others in the exodus to other lands. The majority were lost. By 9500 BC, Atlantis as a nation had vanished from the face of the earth. The Atlantean culture, however, did not entirely pass away. Although there were comparatively high civilizations in China, India and the Pyrenees, Atlantean influence was felt in many places at different times, just as their aggressive and progressive nature is now and will continue to be felt through reincarnation in the earth. The cycle of history often repeats itself, and the spirit of Atlantis has arisen once more, as will portions of the land itself. When changes that are to come about do take place, the island of Poseidia will be among the first high points to appear above sea level. New land will emerge off the east coast of the United States. The Bahama Islands are remnants of the peaks of Poseidia, a part of the once great continent before its breaking up into islands after the second disaster. Near the islands of Bimini, 50 miles off the coast of Miami, Florida, there are buried under ages of sea slime the remains of an old Atlantean temple. It will one day be recovered. In the Pyrenees and Morocco are the ruins of early settlements still to be uncovered. In Honduras, Guatemala and Yucatan, Mexico, The fleeing Atlanteans became known as the Mayas. In North America they settled in New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado and as far east as Mississippi and Ohio, where they came to be known as the Mound Builders. The Iroquois Indians are direct descendants, and traces of Atlantean religious beliefs may be found among other Indian tribes. In Egypt, Atlantean influence was felt in the building of pyramids. There are to be found in Egypt, Bimini and Yucatan duplicate reports of Atlantean history. The records are identical and they will clarify some of the Old Testament accounts. Included in the records are the plans for construction of great crystals. Some of these remains have already been unknowingly recovered by unsuspecting archaeologists in the pyramids of Yucatan. While the earliest recorded date in the case readings is 10.5 million years ago, the second influx of souls of the perfect raceous civilizations rose and fell many times during the Great Atlantean period from 200,000 to 10,700 BC. Between the first and the last destructions was a span of years many times the length of the Christian era to date. The type of culture carried into the Pyrenees and America when the first catastrophe occurred differed from that taken to Central America and Morocco with the second Exodus, and to Egypt and Yucatan, Mexico, with the third and final disaster. Nor could the whole civilization in its entirety be transplanted at any time. A division of tongues took place when the continent was broken up into islands, although the rest of the world still spoke the one language. This further complicated the Atlantean effect on the various civilizations to which the people migrated. Thus man evolves materially and sometimes spiritually, but almost never in a straight line, although generally the trend has always been upward. Here he is a little better, there a little worse, fluctuating like a cork in the sea. Souls rose to great heights, often they fell to low depths, taking others with them. But always there have been the few who were searching for the answer to the mystery of whence they came and whither they are going, and why. The higher way to a more noble and godly life still evades man, yet it is at his fingertips. The present age is a replica in many ways of ancient Atlantis at its height, and our technology can therefore be better understood in the light of Atlantean accomplishments. Atlanteans are now reincarnating in the earth in large numbers, and as the cycle of mankind progresses through the laws of karma, action and reaction, men are faced once again with a world of their own making. Our high civilization presents the first opportunity, under similar circumstances, not only to recompense for the many evils committed but to choose once more between the use of natural TMS forces for constructive or destructive purposes. The case records say, AO as indicated here, this entity is an Atlantean. Hence it is manifesting in the earth at this period when many Atlanteans have entered. For this ye may be very sure, no leader in any country or clime, whether friend or foe of what the entity believes is other than an Atlantean. AO as we have indicated, the Atlanteans had reached such an advancement, and had been entrusted with divine activities on the earth. Due to as did also this entity they forgot from whom and in whom all live and have their being. Thus they brought about within themselves that which destroyed the body, but not the soul. Ao then this is the purpose of the entity in the earth, to be a channel of blessing to someone today I and now. That is, to be a living example of that which he gave, A come unto me, all that are weak and heavy laden, take my cross upon you and learn of me. Atm these are thy purposes in the earth. And those thou will manifest beautifully or again make a miserable failure, as thou didst in Atlantis and as many another soul is doing in this particular era. A case #2794 liter I, we are at the threshold of the testing period. What we do now will decide the fate for mankind for ages to come. End of this article on, or as, excerpt from Story of, The Origin and Destiny of Man. From material via Edgar Cayce.